committee program for the day, and that is not the minutes, because to adopt the minutes you need the quorum, so of course the minutes have moved off. But you will recall before we went on constituency, the subcommittee had done a lot of work on debt relief. We had done some work on it as a committee and taken certain decisions. Is that agreed, Honourable Williams? So now we got to the point of inviting Advocate Van der Merwe, who had been briefed and instructed by this committee on what to prepare and bring here. And she is going to share with us what is being called a draft framework on the committee bill dealing with debt relief. Is everyone on board with that? Right. So I'm immediately going to hand over then to yourself, Advocate Van der Merwe. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. Maybe just to set the scene, the document that I'm going to present to you runs alongside a bill. So as I go through the presentation, I will try my best to refer you to the page in the bill if you want to compare. But I thought it might be easier to show you what the bill says by doing it in a presentation format rather than going clause by clause, which becomes a little bit technical, especially since a number of the first clauses are consequential amendments and actually can be skipped. To get to the meat of the presentation. What I would like to do is to take you through two phrases or words that I am proposing, but as I said in my last presentation, this bill is very much for this committee to have something in front of you which can then be pulled apart, changed, things put in, words changed. And I will explain when we get there. Then I want to talk to you about a preamble, because I've inserted a preamble in this bill, and I'll explain why I did that. Looking at then the actual debt relief measure, because there's two debt relief measures in this bill that the bill is proposing. One is something that will be immediately available only once, and something that will be prescribed. So if we look at the one that will be immediately available, what will be the criteria, how will the application work? I'm proposing the credit regulator and consumer tribunal, but it could be other bodies. The roles of the credit bureau, what will be expected from them? What will be the effects of a successful relief application? And then the second type, which is allowing the minister to prescribe under certain circumstances. Then I'll quickly go through consequential amendments, because really those actually just add a little bit to what the actual meat of this bill is, but they're just necessary for the bill to actually be aligned with the Act. Then I want to talk about in duplum. Initially we thought to also include that in the bill, but I would like to explain why I in the end did not, and then look at the way forward. So if I can start with the terminology. There was a question about debt relief versus debt forgiveness, and from the sources that I could find, it seems that it is a bit of a loose association. Sometimes the one word is used and the other one, and I couldn't really pinpoint a specific use, but most often forgiveness would be some form of extinguishing of debt. In other words, that there is no further debt. It is almost like I forgive and forget about it. Whereas relief seems to be a broader term that is used for more than one type of interference, if I can call it that, in a credit agreement. So I have used the term debt relief, and my rationale for that is when it comes to the first measure, the one that will be immediately available, I am proposing that the tribunal be given a choice of orders, one of which will be to extinguish a debt. And the reason for that is so that we can comply with the limitation clause in the Constitution, so that with each application the least interruptive measure is used. If a consumer qualifies for or would be able to maybe get out of the debt problem by having a 12-month suspension, then that should rather be used than extinguishing the debt. And then also, the prescribed measure, there the minister will be given a number of options because we can't foresee exactly now what in the future will be required. There will have to be more than one type of measure that the minister can do. So that is why I'm proposing debt relief. The second thing is what to call the measure that will be immediately available. I don't know if Mrs. Phipps wants to launch a competition for the best name for this measure. That can be possible. I might sponsor a Coke for the prize. But what I've come up with is once-off, simply because the idea is it will only be a once-off measure. There will be a limit on the debt that qualifies, and the idea is for it not to be repeated. One of the concerns that came out during consultations is that this and from the subcommittee, from this committee itself, we don't want to have a message out there that, you know what, go into debt, it's fine, in 5 years' time, government will bail you out again. So that was my rationale behind once-off. But like I say, it was just a term, and I've explained why I've used it. It can be changed. Now, the preamble in the bill itself is on pages 2 and 3. Normally, an amendment bill does not have a preamble. The reason for that is that an amendment bill slots into an existing bill, an existing act, that already has a preamble that explains why that act is there and what the act wants to achieve. But there are some exceptions where a preamble can be used in an amendment bill. And for instance, in this instance, this preamble will not be transferred to the National Credit Act, but it will remain part of the Amendment Act once it becomes an act. The reason for a preamble is to understand what the legal basis is for that act, and especially where there is some constitutional issues that a bill is addressing. A preamble can assist in the interpretation of that bill to see why and how it addresses the constitutional concern. This bill specifically affects the right to property, and because of that, I thought that it would make sense to say, this is what we are doing. There is a gap, and we are trying to address that gap. What we are doing is not arbitrary. This bill is not something that was just a thumbs up. There is a need. There is something not addressed by legislation at the moment, and this bill is filling that gap. So that is why I am proposing to put the preamble there. Now, there might be the question, but the memorandum on the objects will surely also address that. The problem is that your memorandum on the objects of a bill is a parliamentary process document. Once the bill goes to the president for assent, the memo on objects disappears. So the document that is filed with the Constitutional Court does not have a memo on the objects. It will have the preamble if we have that in. So that is why I put a preamble in the bill. And if you read the preamble, you'll see that I look at the purpose of the Credit Act. I talk about the gap that exists and the fact that there are a number of acts that are simply inaccessible, either because there's a focus on benefits to credit providers or there's a cost involved with the debt relief measures that are in existence. And I then say that without a suitable alternative debt relief measure, you have this gap of people that simply cannot improve their financial position. So, to give effect to the purpose of the Credit Act, that is where this bill comes from. So, from there in the bill itself, there's been a couple of consequential amendments. So, if I can take you through to page 9 of the bill, this is where the meat of the bill starts, this part E. Also the place where I inserted this part E can be changed, but I thought that it fits quite nicely after over indebtedness and rector's credit. It kind of slots in nicely for me there, but it can be changed. So the criteria comes from the subcommittee and this committee, from presentations by National Treasury, by National Credit Regulator, by other people. One of the members made an input. Two major categories will qualify for the once-off debt relief. Someone who is indigent and someone who is a minor heading a household. Those are the two persons, categories that will qualify. Who is indigent? First of all, it must be a natural person. So juristic companies won't qualify for this. Must be a natural person, must be a South African citizen or a permanent resident, receives either no income or, now in the bill I've provided for less than 3,500 rand per month, that amount can change. The stats that I received and when I went through the presentations again, from the credit regulator, I could see that up until 5,500, there are people who are doing debt review. So, but if we look from 2014 to now, there was a significant drop in the debt review numbers in the 0 to 3,500 rand group. So that is why I chose that. But National Treasury said debt review actually only becomes viable for people who earn more than 10,000 rand. So that is something for this committee. That is definitely one of the questions that the committee will still have to grapple with. Another presentation that was done said that your lower income group, unable to afford debt review, they looked at 7,500 rand income. The member who made made some input, Mr. McPherson, suggested less than 5,000. So there's numbers to play around with. It seems that we won't go more than 10,000. But whether we want to go that high is something the committee will still have to decide on. But that is a very small amendment once that amount is decided on. It's simply changing the number. Then this person who is indigent, earning less than a certain amount per month, must also have no realizable assets. And I've defined that, and I'll speak to that on the next slide. And must be over-indebted. And perhaps the credit regulator can help us a bit with the wording, because what I've done is I've linked it to the affordability assessment. But perhaps that is not the right link, but the regulator can assist us there. I want to quickly go and then talk about the realizable assets. So in other words, what assets will disqualify a person? An asset that can be swiftly converted into cash at a value that reasonably reflects the second-hand market value. For this definition, I looked at the New Zealand MENA Act, because they also say that there must be no realizable assets. And they exclude necessary tools of trade, necessary household furniture and effects, and they give a maximum value. They exclude a motor vehicle as well. And then I have added a fund such as a pension fund or a retirement annuity, because I know that there was a concern about people giving up their pension funds in order to pay debt. So I've included, so in other words, the fact that you have a pension fund will not disqualify you for applying. Tools of trade, household furniture, and the vehicle is something I think that this committee will have to discuss. We do have public transport. It might not be the best in the world, but the question is, you know, is this something that we feel should be excluded? So you are allowed to have a motor vehicle and you will still qualify. You are allowed to have certain household assets, but what value? Do we say 5,000 rand? Do we say 10,000 rand? So those are the things that must still be looked at. But again, this is a very small amendment. It is really a couple of decisions that have to be taken. So that is the criteria. The indigent person and a child heading a household. Then the type of debt. Now the first, there's three things that will deal with the debt. The first one is the date. So far, I can propose one of three dates as a cut-off date. The first is 8 December 2016, which was the date that permission was given to do this bill. It might be too far back, I don't know. It's for the committee to decide. Another option is when we publish the bill, or when this bill actually becomes an act, so a future date after it has gone through the parliamentary process and is in fact enacted. The actual amount of the debt is something else that needs to be limited. I could not really find statistics to show the brackets 0 to 3,500 or 0 to 5,500 or even 5,500 to 10,000. What are the average debts that we are looking at? What I could get from the statistics from DebtBusters was 160,000, which includes vehicles and mortgages. So clearly that is too high. One of the members made some inputs and suggested 50,000 unsecured. I don't know if that is not too high as well. But this is perhaps something where further discussion needs to take place so that we can understand what. Because what we need to keep in mind is that the amount that we agree on here, that full amount might be extinguished. So the impact on the credit providers also needs to be considered. You know, the converse of it. So that is the other thing. Then it must be unsecured debt. So in other words, if you have a house that where there is a bond on, then that debt cannot form part of your application. That debt you need to service. If you fail on that, there is a measure for the credit provider. I know that there was a concern about people not losing their houses. They've paid off quite a lot of the house and then they lose. But that is perhaps something that we need to think about how to address. And I don't think it necessarily forms part of a debt relief measure as such. It is perhaps something that needs to be addressed in a different way. I know we had Justice in here to talk to us about these auctions where houses are just sold for next to nothing. So that is perhaps the more appropriate forum for that discussion. Still on the type of debt, I've already now gone a little bit further on the, I'm now on page 11 of the bill. This will also depend on the amount of the debt that this committee agrees on. I would almost suggest that we do think about this 15,000 rand, whether we say 15,000 max, or we accept that you might have two agreements of 15,000 each coming to 30,000. You know, so that could maybe be a rationale about it. Small credit agreements is anything less than 50,000. Intermediate goes over 15,000. So if we say up to 15,000, we will limit it to small credit agreements. If we go over 15,000, we can include intermediate credit agreements. But pawn transactions won't be included, mortgages or credit guarantees won't be included. Then there is one. When I did this bill, I had to read through the whole of the Act to make sure that this bill fits in snugly and that we don't disturb what the Act already is achieving. The Act has something called developmental credit agreement. It's provided for in Section 10, and it includes educational loans, low-income housing, and loans for socioeconomic development. For a Section 10 developmental credit agreement, the credit provider does not have to do a reckless lending, the affordability assessment. Reckless lending does not apply to these agreements. So I thought that it should perhaps be included as a type of agreement that would qualify for debt relief, but perhaps we need to be careful and we need to make it almost a category of its own. I'll get to that when I get to the orders. So just tie a knot in your ear. Section 10 developmental credit agreements are included, but we may need to look at how to treat this. So that is now we know who qualifies and we know the type of debt. We know there's a period, there will be an amount, and we know we are looking at certain types of agreements. when we apply, there's two things that we need to keep in mind. There might be processes already. In fact, it's one thing to keep in mind, there might be already processes. The one might be a civil action in a magistrate's court, and the other might be a debt review process that's already underway. Now, in the bill, I have included that if there is already civil proceedings in a court, then the person will not be able to bring an application for debt relief. The reason for that is so that we don't frustrate court processes. But what I have done is I've made some consequential amendments to other sections in the Act. And I've now said that a court can take judicial notice of whether debt relief is necessary. And the court can then refer. So in other words, the court decides if this process needs to stop because clearly there is a problem here. Then on a debt review process, I have said that the person can bring an application for debt relief. But this is something perhaps that the committee needs to consider, is there is a risk to this. We are saying that we are trying to address a gap where people can't really afford debt review. If we now say, you've afforded debt review, you're part of the process, you're busy with it, now you can come and bring an application for debt relief, because your end result will probably be that the person will be referred back for debt review. On the other hand, someone under debt review might have circumstances that are changing, and it might become unaffordable. And instead of starting to default, that person might then be allowed to come and bring an application for debt relief. So there is a risk, but it is something to consider. I have gone with allowing an application for debt relief, even if you are currently undergoing debt review, because I was thinking of circumstances might be changing, and I have provided for the regulator and the tribunal to refer a person back to debt review if they feel that that's a more appropriate solution. The rest of the... The application itself is on pages 11, 12 on the bill, and then page 12 of the bill, subsection 4, indicates the type of things that must be in the application. Now, this is really detailed that I think when the committee actually goes clause by clause and we look at subsection by subsection, some of these things can come out. We can decide that they should rather be prescribed. I am making provision for some things to be prescribed. It does, however, mean that there will have to be some monitoring to make sure that those regulations are almost ready at the same time that the bill is getting in operation. So we need to just keep in mind that then does necessitate further action. But the thing with the regulations is that it is much easier to prescribe procedure in regulations because it can be changed so much faster if we see something isn't working. So there are pros and cons to that, but like I said, that is the kind of thing where we can, when we do detail, we can chop and change and add and say, no, let this be prescribed or not. Then the actual, so now the application, we know who qualifies, the application has been brought. This person has given us all these things, the information about credit and the outstanding and expenses and income, etc., in terms of that, say, subsection 4. Page 13. Section 88B now talks about the evaluation. I have made the application to be to the National Credit Regulator and for the regulator to refer to the tribunal. It is not to say that these must be the two bodies who deal with the debt relief, but they are in existence. They have running procedures. If we want something to start running the moment the bill becomes an act, it is probably more practical to choose organizations that are in existence than having to set organizations up. So that is just a practical thing to keep in mind. Also, in the subcommittee, the National Credit Regulator has indicated that they would be able to handle applications. We haven't spoken to the tribunal. I've kind of canvassed very, very, very broadly with them about this possibility. And it seems that they would be likely, but that is maybe something else that the committee needs to do, is to confirm the capacity in both the regulator and the tribunal to decide if they are the most appropriate. So for purposes of this presentation, I'm going to say regulator and tribunal. Keep in mind it might be another body. So when the regulator then receives the application, we have the consumer, like on the slide, the first part talks, there's still section 88A, subsection 4, what the consumer gives. Then the regulator will give notice, will first say to the consumer, thank you, I have received your application. Why is that necessary? So that the consumer, when a credit provider serves them with a letter of demand or a summons, can say, no, I've got an application for debt relief. Here's my proof from the regulator that the application is in fact there. But also, the regulator needs to confirm with all credit providers and also every registered credit bureau that there is an application. And the reason for that is because we then give the credit providers an opportunity to add information to this application. Now, the type of information could be facts that might disqualify the consumer. A credit provider might, in an affidavit, state, here is the pay slip that the consumer provided with me 30 days ago that says that this consumer is earning 20,000 Rand. So that will then contribute to the evaluation. It might result in a rejection of the application. But also, the credit provider may submit an affidavit that talks to the types of order that the tribunal may make. The reason that I thought of that is I want to, in the tribunal, avoid a hearing where there's witnesses being led, etc. I want the tribunal to be able to decide on papers. So we need to give the credit provider an opportunity to put their case before the tribunal. If the credit provider, for instance, is a very small company in a very small town that has 20 consumers on their loan book, and all of those are people who maybe have done developmental loans. So it's all educational in nature. So there was no reckless lending, or rather all of those will probably be reckless lending if that is applied, but we know Section 10 developmental loans, that is not applicable. But that credit provider might say to the tribunal, look, if you extinguish these 20 people's debt, then I am out of business and I am providing educational loans. Rather give them a suspension because I can still run my business if that is the case. So in other words, just give a little bit of background how it will affect the credit provider. So there is an opportunity for the credit provider to put some facts before the tribunal. Once this has now been done, so the tribunal has received the information from the consumer, from the credit provider, the national credit regulator must then work through the application. Secured debts must be excluded, and it must identify reckless lending or unlawful lending transactions. Now, we did not really want to touch on reckless lending and unlawful lending because there's already provision made for it. But the concern is that the type of consumer category that we are targeting here, there is quite likely to be some reckless lending or unlawful transactions. Those need to be excluded. And the regulator has said to us that they don't have the power to actually declare those as unlawful and then the agreements as void. So I am making a little bit of a provision for them here, but under the debt relief application. So if they identify reckless lending or unlawful lending transactions, they can refer that to the tribunal, who can then declare them void. So at least we deal with that category of people, the consumers who qualify. If there's reckless lending and unlawful lending, we are addressing that concern about how do we get this to the tribunal if it doesn't automatically come to the regulator. So we make provision for that. The other thing that they then do is the regulator will see if the consumer's application does not qualify. In other words, this is the case where the credit provider said, no, this consumer earns 20,000 Rand a month. Here's the pay slip. Credit regulator maybe phones up the business, yeah, no, you're employed. very, very, very good employee, then it can be rejected. Or the credit regulator may decide this is more a case for debt review. This is not really, this consumer can repay, and in fact the cost of the debt review is something that can be worked in. That can then also be done. The credit regulator may refer to debt review. Ms. McPherson actually proposed that there could be a possible remedy to provide subsidized debt review fees. Now, the thing is, it's a pity that he's not here, but maybe in a later meeting he can explain to the committee what he means by that, because if it is something that government must subsidize, we need to ask the question, where does the money come from? That's a big question. If it is something else that was canvassed, a fund where credit providers will pay a fee or a levy into, that is something that we need to carefully look at. And maybe it is a future thing to do, because if it becomes a levy, then it becomes a money bill and can only be introduced by the Minister of Finance. Also, if it is money that is paid to a fund held by the DTI, that is money taken out of the fiscus. In other words, it's money received by DTI, but it doesn't form part of the fiscus. And if that is the case, Minister of Finance must give permission that can, in fact, be done. So, you know, I don't know which way he was proposing it. It's probably not a bad idea. It is something that was canvassed by a number of people to say, if we can just subsidize these debt review fees, that will already address a number of problems. But the question is, where does the money come from? But perhaps this provision in the bill that the credit regulator may refer the matter for debt review gives a little bit of scope for the DTI to enter into agreements and maybe get debt reviewers on a procurement panel or anything like that. I'm not sure. They will have to be further looking into it. But it might give them the scope to do that kind of interaction where certain debt reviewers, debt counsellors are willing to maybe at a subsidised or a lower amount, not subsidised, a lower amount, do certain things, etc. So there is a little bit of scope, but I'm not saying it explicitly. So it is for DTI to decide how they will do that. So then if there's something reckless, unlawful, that is referred to the tribunal. And if the person qualifies, then the regulator also refers that application to the tribunal for an order related to want of debt relief. Now, in the tribunal itself, the bill provides, first off, that applications can be heard by a single member of the tribunal, and it can be done by motion procedure. In other words, they only have to consider, sorry, I want to say to you, I am now on page 15 of the bill. So they may only look at the documents in front of them. If there's a dispute on the papers, if there is something, nothing stops the tribunal from calling a witness, but the principle is to say, as a base, you can look at the documents only, and that will be sufficient hearing of this application. Because we don't want a thing where your application drags out to 5 days before the tribunal. That is not the purpose of what we want here. The idea is to have all the facts on paper and then be able to make a decision from that. If the tribunal agrees that a transaction is reckless or unlawful, they can declare them as such, and that is then void. Or if there is an existing restructuring agreement and there is some problem with that, they can order specific performance, or they can grant once of debt relief or a combination of orders. And then I think this is the one that is the most interesting. What are these once of debt relief orders? And this is on page 17 of the bill. First off, we're looking at repayment. So, in fact, I just want to, before I go into this, there has been some, in fact, Ms. McPherson made the input that we must first try and make sure that the current existing measures allowed by the credit National Credit Act are actually exhausted. And from the previous slide, it's clear that that is in fact what is happening. The tribunal will consider, the regulator will consider whether debt review is more appropriate. Even the tribunal can consider that. So we are not just excluding the current act. It is to be applied. But we are also making something extra available, and that would be either of one of three main orders plus conditions. Again, like I say, it's proposals. It's based on information from the subcommittee, the committee, but I've also looked at the requirements from, because we're affecting property, what is required. I've looked at the NINA program, and this has been what I propose. Some of the NINA programs do a very rigid set of orders. It's order number one. It's suspended for 12 months. Order number two, if you after 12 months still can't pay, then this. Then what I've done is to say, rather than having a rigid set of orders, let us allow the tribunal to say, these are the orders that you can make. We're very clear about that. You can't go outside of these orders. So we're giving clarity, which is one of the requirements for the law of general application. But we are saying that it is not just an arbitrary, non-thinking kind of order. The tribunal must make sure that it's the least interference with the relationship between the consumer and the credit provider. It is really the type of order that is necessary to assist this credit provider. So in that instance, the tribunal can say, I am going to say, this is the maximum interest fees or other charges. This is the maximum amount repayable. And currently, the bill limits that to 6 months. That was based on some inputs from Mr. McPherson. He said 6 months.
Hold on a minute. An exigency has arisen with a transport for members.
So initially, I drafted the bill to simply state that the tribunal can do this maximum interest, maximum amount repayable for such a period as the tribunal thinks fair. But as Mrs. Phipps indicated at the previous meeting, the inputs received from members, I tried to accommodate that. So the committee can perhaps decide whether the period of 6 months is something that works. But I must be very honest, I think it's maybe a too short a period, especially because this is repayment on limited amounts, you know. I think it must be something that's reviewable, but it can perhaps be 12 months or 24 months and then reviewable. Debt review, for instance, takes place over a period of, I think, 5 years or so. So, you know, we're now limiting this to 6 months. I'm not sure that is sufficient time, but again, that's something the committee can think about. The other thing that the tribunal can do is to actually suspend the enforcement of the credit agreement what I've done here is to say 12 months. Before the expiry of that 12 months, the consumer must come back to the tribunal, give the new financial circumstances, and then the tribunal can perhaps extend it for the suspension for one more year, one more period of 12 months, or the tribunal can say, no, in the past 12 months, I can see nothing has happened, or I can see you now can start repayment. And then the tribunal can make one of the other orders. So the tribunal can either determine about repayment, refer for debt review, or extinguish if they see this person really will not be able to make any payments. The third option is extinguishing of the debt. So this is where there's insufficient prospect that the consumer may improve his or her financial circumstances over the next 12 months. And I think that insufficient prospect is really something that is likely to make the extinguishing of debt one of the less frequently given orders by the tribunal. But it allows the tribunal to give this order where it is quite clear that a person, for whatever reason, is definitely not able to get a job. This person might indicate that they have been looking for jobs now for so many months, etc. So all of those personal circumstances will show the tribunal whether there is in fact a prospect of getting an employment, in which case they can suspend for 12 months, or if there is really no prospect, then why suspend for 12 months? Let's just get it over and done with, and it can then be extinguished. It might also be that we've now already reached the point where it was suspended for 12 months. We can see that this person tried, with the new circumstances presented, trying to get a job, really nothing. The job that comes in, maybe 1,000 rand a month, 2,000 rand a month, which is simply not sufficient. And then that is when this order can be made. Then I also have allowed for the tribunal to make certain conditions that can go with any of these orders. And it can be in respect of the execution of the order, whether there must be notice, etc. In respect of the credit agreement itself, and then something that I know the committee was feeling we must be very careful about this is the limiting of the consumer's right to apply for credit. In other words, disqualifying the consumer for further credit. The reason I did include limiting the consumer's right is that this is not a measure. If the tribunal grants debt relief, the consumer should not take this lightly. The consumer should understand that there are consequences with this debt relief that is granted. But I have made it that it is not a mandatory period. So, for instance, the example I can think of is a person who has an exemplary credit record, absolutely exemplary. Then the person is retrenched. And now for the past 12 months, the records can show that this person really has tried to do whatever they can to pay, etc. And with the 12-month suspension, this person actually pulled themselves back up and has maybe for 3 months shown that they're a good consumer. Then the tribunal can say, no, I'm not going to make it a 5-year that you can't apply for credit. I might give you a 6 months or a 12-month period for which you won't qualify, just for the circumstances, or even a 0 months, depending on the circumstances. In the input made by Ms. McPherson, he wanted this to be mandatory. It is something that the committee can think about, but like I say, I know that the committee was very hesitant to even bring this measure in. So my proposal is a compromise, to say, let us allow for that to be done, but let's make it discretionary. So the tribunal can make the order when it is something that they are of the view is actually something that is needed for the consumer to rehabilitate him or herself. Another order is to look at financial literacy, to attend a financial literacy or budgeting skills program, in other words, to educate the consumer on finances. Again, Mr. McPherson wanted this to be mandatory, but the whole setup of the tribunal's orders is very much a discretion, so that the tribunal, within a set parameter, can look at the financial circumstances, personal circumstances of the consumer and make an appropriate order. The example that I've given before, the consumer who was very good at the debt, but because of retrenchment fell into on a hard time, that is perhaps not the kind of person who will need to be trained. That person understands how to budget, how to do everything. It was just a temporary setback for that person. And then it might not be applicable. So that is why I've made that also discretionary. Then, maybe just some more on this limiting the right to apply for credit. And at this point in time, I am now on pages 18, going over on page 19 of the bill. But just to show you what it will come down to, because I also thought that, you know, the type of orders that I'm providing for kind of varies in severity. So if there is a repayment order, perhaps we should limit the tribunal to a maximum of 24 months from the date of the order that the person can be disqualified. So in other words, the order is 6 months or an extension to 12 months, plus a maximum of 12 months that the tribunal can say, no, you should not be able to apply for credit, you need 12 months to rehabilitate. So on repayment, it comes down to a maximum of 24 months. If there was suspension, and in the end, either repayment or another order, it comes down to a maximum of 48 if there was an extension of the suspension, otherwise 36, so 3 years, from the date of order. So normally it works from the end of the process. Remember that this works from the date of order. If there was extinguishing, then we are looking at the 60 months maximum from the date of order for the person to rehabilitate before they can apply for credit again. But like I say, this is something to consider. I have made it discretionary because I think that it might be something that needs to be a little bit careful about. It's the intention is not to take someone out of the market. It's to give them just that needed break. What we can also do is to say that during this period, a person's the limit on a person's right to apply for credit is limited to a certain amount. In the New Zealand NINA, they actually have a prescribed amount that may not be exceeded. So instead of a blanket zero, they say for this period, you may not apply for more credit than and then whatever the prescribed amount is. We would probably put in amount in this event. Then, the one thing that I forgot to say on the extinguishing, I have provided that developmental credit, the loan under Section 10 for educational, for low-cost housing, that type of credit, I am suggesting that that not be able to be extinguished. So it can be suspended, it can be capped, but it cannot be extinguished. And my rationale for that is because credit providers already take a bigger risk because they don't have to do the affordability assessment. They know that these people might not be able to pay back that loan, that educational loan. And I was thinking that in order to ensure that they don't stop giving that educational loan, that loan for low-cost housing, that we say, look, that kind of loan may be suspended, it won't be extinguished. But that is something for the committee to decide, because on the other hand, I'm also proposing that during this period where we limit the right to apply, that we do allow the consumer to apply for an educational loan, socioeconomic loan, in other words, these developmental loans. So I am putting them in a bit of a different category. and that is perhaps something I think maybe that the committee needs to almost discuss on its own. What do we do with developmental loans? Should they be included? Should we extinguish them? Should they be able to apply for them during the period where we want them to be rehabilitating? Now, we need to somehow make it known that this credit provider, this consumer, is currently either having agreement suspended, may not incur more than a certain amount of debt, etc. So we need to have listings on credit bureaus, but then we need to look at getting this information off from that credit bureau's records. So what I'm proposing is that 7 days after the relevant period expires, they must remove that information. So either the capping period or the suspension period or where there was a period imposed on during which the consumer can't apply for credit, 7 days after that. Where the debt was extinguished, because there might not be any period, then I'm saying 12 months after the date of the order. These dates can, of course, be changed. But it is simply that I would suggest that we have something to say when credit bureaus must remove that information. So what would be the consequences of a successful application? And I am now on page 20 of the bill. Now, first off, if there's an application, what I'm providing in the bill is once a consumer has applied for debt relief, they may not incur any further charges under a credit facility or enter into further credit agreements. So that we don't have a situation where someone applies and then goes and gets further credit. If they accept any referral for debt review, they must, of course, comply with the Act. But conversely, the credit provider, once the credit provider gets notice that there's an application, they may not institute legal proceedings to claim back any money under that credit agreement. They must also wait for the process to be finalized. Now, once the debt relief is granted, the consumer must, of course, comply with whatever the conditions of the order are. If the right to apply for credit is limited, then they must comply with that and they may not incur any further charges or enter into further credit agreements for that time. Here I'm saying they may apply for developmental credit, but there is a risk. We need to maybe consider whether that is appropriate. And then this comes from the New Zealand MENA Act. If there's a change in financial circumstances, they must notify the credit regulator of those circumstances. I've given a time period, just to see what I said. I think I said about 60 days from the event that caused the change in circumstances. Because circumstances could change for good or for bad. So maybe the order was for repayment, but the income that the consumer had might have fallen away. So now this consumer is going to fall into arrears, and rather than that happen, rather go back to the credit regulator, get the order amended so that we get the appropriate order. On the other hand, the consumer might get a very good job and might now be able to, where maybe the debt was suspended, might now be able to start paying immediately. But all of this must happen in a controlled environment. It's not something that we can just say must happen. So that is why it must go back to the regulator and to the tribunal for an order. The question, of course, is in the New Zealand MENA Act, failure to do this is an offence. I have not made it an offence in this bill, and it is something that the committee will have to instruct me on. My rationale was, if the person does not inform the regulator or the tribunal of the change in circumstances, and that knowledge comes to the tribunal or the regulator, the person is disqualified from the debt relief. So if it was extinguished, the person will have to start repaying. That, for me, is the consequence of not telling. To make it an offence, what I'm concerned about is the person that we're dealing with, the consumer that we're dealing with, might be illiterate, might not be close to a phone, might not be able to get to town to report this. And then we make it an offence, and suddenly this person ends up in jail. If there was fraud involved, then that's fraud in any event. We don't have to say in this act that it's fraud. It's fraud. To lie to the tribunal is fraud. And that can be you know, it's an offence under the Normal Criminal Procedure Act. So I don't think we need to, but like I say, it is provided in the New Zealand, so there is precedent for it, but it is for the committee to advise me. From the credit provider side, if debt relief is granted in the sense that some agreement was declared reckless or unlawful or debt was extinguished, then the credit provider may not exercise or enforce by litigation any rights under that agreement. It is then done. So, the next page, next slide, sorry, is on page 21 going over to 23. So, if the consumer's financial circumstances change, the tribunal may amend or rescind the debt relief. If the consumer was dishonest, may amend or rescind. If they did not comply with the conditions of the order or failed to comply with restrictions, that the tribunal may amend or rescind the warrants of debt relief, which I think is already, for someone who qualified, I think it's already a big issue. Mr. McPherson, in his submission, proposed an aftercare mechanism to monitor consumers who receive warrants of debt relief to see whether this measure is in fact effective, etc., etc. I did not put anything into the bill because I thought perhaps the credit regulator can just guide us a bit whether this is not something that would happen in any event in order to do the annual reports that come to Parliament to show the effectiveness implementation of legislation. If they say no, it's not really enough, then perhaps they can just assist us with the type of measure that would assist us in especially this committee, in monitoring the success of this measure. Then when we get to the second measure, this is the one, so we have now dealt with the measure that will be immediately available. We know who qualifies, we know the debt, we know what the consequences are. When the minister prescribes debt relief measures, and what I've done here is I've taken from discussions from the subcommittee, the committee itself, and I've kind of borrowed from what I've already done in the once-off, and I've put them all together. So you will recognize some of these things as I go through them. What would be the measure? Something where interest is capped, charges, fees are capped, suspension of credit agreements, extinguishing of debts. And then I've added something else here to provide for a liquidation process for consumers with minimal income and assets. Because what the once-off process does is a type of a NINA, but we limit it to certain debt up to a certain amount and debt up to a certain date. So it won't be available in future. But we know that there is a gap. There is no process currently available for consumers where there is no benefit to credit providers. You can't be sequestrated. And if you can't afford the debt review, then that is just where you are. If you can afford the debt review, you're still at a disadvantage to a person who was sequestrated, in that the person who was sequestrated, there's dire consequences. I'm not saying it's nice to be sequestrated, but that person can actually start their life again. Whereas the debt review is a long process that allows the consumer to repay the debt. But at the end of that process, the question is, are they actually rehabilitated? Are they able to again get into the finance market, etc.? So there is definitely a gap for people, so that we have an informal process, like the actual NINA process in New Zealand, and in the UK and in Wales, which is an ongoing process. They have different issues, though. For instance, like I said, it starts off with the suspension, and then there are more rigorous requirements than what we've had in this bill. But then that is something else that the minister perhaps should actually be looking at quite in the recent, in the near future. Who must be the beneficiaries? Again, you will recognize them. Indigent persons, child-headed households. I've also added retrenchments in a sector identified by the minister and natural disasters in a sector or region identified by the minister. Not just is those be the beneficiaries, it must also be if there was a significant, and the word here, exogenous, actually just means external shock. So it mustn't be something caused by the group themselves that caused widespread job losses. So for instance, a drought, that kind of thing. A regional natural disaster that is of grave public interest, and here I tied in with the Act, Section 11 speaks of public interest loans. So I've just tied them together. Or where there is no efficient or effective method to alleviate household debt available. And that one is to speak to the liquidation process, the informal liquidation process, to say there isn't an efficient or effective method available to these people. So that is when and what the minister can prescribe. Now the process is that the minister must consult the National Assembly. I did not put in the name of this committee because in a bill, an act, we actually refer to the two houses, and the house will then refer to the relevant committee. So Then if the minister wants to go broader than the criteria mentioned, I'm saying that the minister actually needs to get permission from the House. So it's not just enough to say, I want to go broader. You will have to get permission. The minister must also consult the ministers responsible for finance and justice, the National Credit Regulator, sorry, I think my slide is this regulator, and the tribunal, as well as the credit industry. The minister must then publish in the Government Gazette the type of measure that he or she contemplates, what the consequences would be, what the group of consumers targeted would be, the type and value of the targeted debt, and what the process for application and approval will be. The minister must give 30 days for comments. The 30 days can perhaps be extended. Committee needs to think about that. But on the other hand, if you have a natural disaster, 30 days is already a very long time for comment. Then, and this I think is the big catch, the minister can't just say, oh, okay, I've now done that. The minister will have to table a report in the assembly to say, these are the comments that I received, and this is what I've done with the comments. So I think that it's very clear that the Parliament is saying, Minister, we want to give you this enabling power to do this, to bring in these measures, but we want to be very careful about it. So, and I think that is the message sent, and that is how I understood the committee when we talked about possible prescribing of measures. The next two slides, I'm just going to quickly go through them. It's consequential amendments. It is things like the purpose of the Act, where the Act does not talk about, the purpose of the Act is worded as that debt must always be honoured. And I'm saying, but already it isn't, because we're talking about capping of interest, etc. So I'm just bringing that in alignment with current practice, and then of course with the debt relief where we might provide for extinguishing. Making debt relief applicable to incidental agreements. And I've made a note here to say we need some advice from trading industry or the regulator on whether incidental agreements should be part of the debt relief measure. What is an incidental agreement? That is something where actually it wasn't a credit agreement at all. But because payment wasn't made at a certain date, suddenly interest is applicable. And then it becomes an incidental agreement. So there was never an intention for it to be a credit agreement. But that is maybe where the department can give us some feedback and we can decide, the committee can decide whether it should be in there. Other thing is to make it very clear that the measure is not available to juristic persons, to make sure that the functions of the credit bureaus actually include debt relief measures, to make sure that debt review and debt relief can limit the right to apply for credit. Currently, the Act simply says everyone has the right to apply for credit. I'm saying, but that's not right, because once you have debt review, that right's limited. So I'm actually just correcting that as well, but also it definitely applies to the debt relief. Providing for the regulator to keep records of debt relief applications in a register, and for the credit bureau to keep that information in their records. Then also another consequential is to empower a court to take judicial notice of over-indebtedness and to refer a consumer, empowering the tribunal to declare a credit agreement unlawful. I think that the tribunal thinks that they can do it currently, but it's not clear for me from the Act. So I thought, well, let me make it clear that they can do it. Then also just to say that if the Consumer Tribunal granted execution or extinguishment of a debt or declared it reckless or void, a credit provider may no longer enforce that credit agreement. Also to say a court may dismiss a matter before it if the tribunal ordered extinguishing of the debt. Now, it's logical things that just to clean the Act up so that we don't have bad interpretation, and providing for the regulator to refer debt relief applications to the tribunal. Also providing that orders of the tribunal are binding on a consumer and a credit provider. It doesn't say so at the moment. I accept that it is, but like I said, I would prefer that is there. And then just to amend the long title of the Act so that we now include debt relief measures specifically. Then I want to just quickly want to speak to the committee about in duplum. Injupium is that nasty Latin rule that says if the outstanding debt reaches, the outstanding debt is about, let's say, 10 rand, and your interest has reached 10 rand because you're not paying, then the credit provider must stop charging interest. They can't charge more than the outstanding capital of the debt. And trade has indicated to us that the problem is that all these charges still keep on running. So we said, okay, we'll include that in the bill. But as I worked through the Act, I came across Section 103 sub 5, which says exactly that. So it's already provided for. It says, despite any provision in the common law, which is the Injupium rule, the amount contemplated in Section 101, 1B to G, and I list them there for you on the slide, initiation fees, service fees, interest, cost of any credit insurance, default administration charges, collection costs. Those charges, where the consumer is in default under a credit agreement, may not in aggregate exceed the unpaid balance of the principal debt. So it is provided for. Perhaps trade, if they say to us that this is not effective, that is maybe something else to look at. But I was not going to duplicate something that is already in the Act. It is perhaps just a matter of enforcing and maybe training and letting the word get out. The way forward, I have spoken with the tribunal by email, and they indicated to me that they don't think the Superior Courts Act would be applicable, but I would recommend that the committee do consider that. What the Superior Courts Act says is that the Minister of Justice must be consulted if any bill is going to be introduced in Parliament that amends the structure or functions of a court of law or tribunal. And I'm of the view that they are a tribunal for purposes of this Act. And it will not take anything from this committee. In fact, it will simply add to consult and confirm that the Minister is in agreement with... Well, we don't have to get his agreement. He must just be consulted and be given an opportunity to comment. Of course, definitely further inputs are necessary from the regulator and the tribunal, deliberations. And then something that I think maybe, or it feels to me that it's falling by the wayside, is there is a bigger review of the Credit Act underway. And there have been requests that certain things be included in this bill, and this committee has time and again said, no, we want to focus on a small area. But perhaps what we need to, or what the committee might want to consider, is to ask the Credit Regulator Tribunal, the DTI, where that review is at the moment. Because if that review affects this bill or vice versa, it is something that the committee needs to keep in mind. In other words, if something is going to be changed in the Act that might affect what we are doing in this bill, then we might have to tweak the bill. So it is important that we don't lose sight of that bigger review and that doesn't fall by the wayside, because it doesn't help this measure is brought in, but all the other things still remain outstanding. That is my presentation on the bill. Like I say, it is now for the committee to pull it apart.
Well, look, just in terms of the process, as you can see from our schedule here, we have already identified and earmarked that we would kick off, if you like, in earnest with deliberations tomorrow morning. It also gives one the opportunity this evening to digest and go through it. But we've also allocated the whole of Thursday. I haven't just got it in front of me, but I think we start at 8:30 on Thursday. And is it 9 o'clock Thursday? 9 o'clock Thursday, and we continue till 4, maybe 4:30, you know, whenever it is. So we'll see how we go through this. Right. Just, I mean, you know, you want to avoid peak hour, don't you? So we could go on till 6. So anyway, the main thing is it becomes quite dynamic. So at lunchtime, we'll make a final decision. The point I'm making, Advocate, is first of all, you've done a tremendous amount of work on this bill. And in fact, when I got the request from Honourable Macpherson, you know, could he not just have an extension? Remember, the decision was, I think, a week before that and whatever to close off. My view was that one mustn't be so rigid, you know. I mean, for heaven's sake, sure, you've finished 80% of it or 90, but does it matter? You know, whatever he's added in, and you haven't already got it there, you can add to it, which I see you've done very effectively. So I think that once again underlines the fact that this is a committee bill. You know, and it is something that we have got to reach, as I put it in the email to Honourable Macpherson, sufficient consensus on, so that we go forward together on it. That's the first thing. But really, just before we even start, you know, clarifying a couple of things, thank you very much for the work that you have done, very professionally as well, and I believe taken into account, you know, what amounts to almost 9 months, as long as it is, you know, the gestation period for a baby, so it is for a bill, it seems. So, but there we are. So, members, you know, clearly you'll want to digest this, but there are some points right now that I know I'd like to clarify, and I'm sure you would. So, over to members. Honourable Williams, I see, got his hand up there first, yes?
Thank you, Chair. Okay, I've got a few things I just want to pick apart, as you said. First of all, in terms of natural disasters, there's a lot of requirements for the Minister to do it before any debt relief or any measures can be taken. Now, that's going to take a lot of time, and I'm just wondering, for instance, if there was a massive fire in an informal settlement, for instance, and 5,000 people became homeless, and now the minister has to spend 2.5 months requesting parliament, etc., 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 how does that, I know those people will eventually get some sort of relief, but don't we want to have some immediate relief that the minister can do in the event of such a huge disaster? Secondly, Section 88B3, the section that talks about the credit provider can put in an affidavit to stop there being any action taken. I'd just like to know, surely this clause would undermine the intent of the bill itself, because the credit provider could fundamentally just put in affidavits all the time and just stop the whole process every time. So I just want to know, how do we prevent that from happening? How do we prevent the credit provider from exploiting 88B3? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Macpherson. Is there anyone else on the... sorry, Mum, I was just actually... no, I was looking at something... looking at something here, my dear. No, I don't think that should worry us at all. It may simply be a reflection of the chair's eyesight. Honourable Tierko?
It's not a question, it's a comment on slide 17. You said, advocate, you said something like offence penalties. How do we address that? Because if somebody went to an extent of applying for that relief, it means the same process can be applied again. So there's no way somebody can disappear. So the issue of penalties, we need to enforce it. It's a must. We are not just handing out money. Then we expect, because we'll be doing that, then people will be saying, no, I've relocated, I mean, wherever. Because on top of that, we must put system in place, the monitoring system. People must be on the ground, make sure that those people that are not repeating the same problem, because we'll be finding ourselves in a serious trouble. So the issue of penalty, I don't know how, but it should be there.
Thank you very much, Honourable Tierko. I have to be a bit more careful now. You know, we're looking here and looking up. Honourable Van Schalkwyk, thanks for just taking the chair on for a short while.
Thank you, Chairperson. You didn't give me enough time to exercise my power. On a lighter note. But I'm thinking, Chair, when we look specifically in the with regards to change of circumstances and looking at consequences, I want to propose another angle that there should be provision made in terms of liaising with the Department of Labor in terms of updated employment status. Because surely if a person is employed, that must reflect in the database space of Department of Labor or somehow something like that. Maybe we can explore it better, advocate. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, thank you very much, Honourable Van Skalkveld. I have a couple of questions on that. Somewhere here, I read about the pawn shop or something. I was always under the impression that, clearly it's because I haven't been near a pawn shop, but I understood that you had to hand in some good, and on the basis of, say, your watch or ring or whatever it was, you could borrow a certain amount, and that dealer made sure it was not even 10% he gave you of whatever you were handing in. So I'm not sure how you could be in debt there per se when they had already secured their funds, if I may put it that way. Perhaps you can explain how that works. The other one that worried me, I know this committee has been emphasizing and re-emphasizing, this is not just a question of debt relief. We want to encourage, back to back with that, a culture of savings. We've been saying that all along. But having said that, you know, reality can be very strange. And that is, you're already on debt relief. You've had debt relief. And now you can't access it for 2 years, 1 year, 5 years, whatever it is. But blow me down, if a hurricane, tornado, or whatever doesn't come, or a fire, you would have been fine, but now you've lost even that shack and the beds, etc. So, you know, it was just another misfortune before you qualified to get alone. And I thought, you know, I don't believe that this takes account of those circumstances. And believe you me, fires continue to occur quite frequently in informal settlements and the like, you see. And we saw that even in the so-called, the other day in some fancy suburb or other, the forest fires down here in the Western Cape. Those are multi-million rand homes that went up as well. So that's the one aspect. The other one here, which talks about, you can already be getting debt counselling or whatever, getting this help, and you wouldn't automatically qualify then for debt relief, automatically. However, you made reference to certain circumstances which in the Act we could even specify or appeal and indicate that a court could make such an order. Do you remember on one of the clauses here? So perhaps you can clarify that, because, while one is getting debt relief, one's circumstances can also change. While I agree with the point you made about if one's circumstances change, it shouldn't amount to a criminal offence if you haven't reported this change, I agree with that. But on the other hand, we do need to ensure that that becomes known as soon as possible, as it were. And there has to be some mechanism that we use that would really spread this around the country, that please indicate that as soon as your circumstances change. Even if it is at the local undertaker or whatever. All right, thank you.
Thank you. First off, Honourable Williams, in respect of natural disasters, the question on what if there's a big fire and to get immediate relief is the same question that we've been struggling with this bill. And the problem is the Constitution. And I say it with all due respect to our Constitution, but there are rights of other people involved. So if we give immediate relief, you know, there's property rights being affected. So if we look at what is required, if the minister sparks, with all due respect, it can be done in 30 days. Because, or maybe not 30 days, probably 45 days, let's put it like that, because there's a 30-day period for comments. That's the only period that really gives a time limit. But the consultations can all happen within that 30-day period. Then the minister needs to file a report in Parliament. We do not say that he must wait to promulgate the regulations before that report. But I would hope that it won't happen afterwards necessarily, but at least that report would be a method of accountability in respect of the comments that were received. So immediately, if the disaster strikes, if the department has the act together, that there can be a call for comments, consultations can immediately happen. The report can be filed in Parliament within a week from the comments being received, and the minister can at the same time promulgate the regulations. So it can be done in 45 days. I understand that the ideal would be to have something immediately, but like I say, there needs to be also an assessment of the impact on credit providers. The Act currently does provide in Section 11 for public interest loans in the event of such a disaster. So there is a measure that is not as radical as a debt relief measure. I'm not sure necessarily that that is sufficient, but also in respect of public interest loans, I now speak under correction, maybe the regulator can help me, the affordability assessments don't apply to sections 10 and 11. So there is a measure, it's just not this measure. In respect of the credit provider and the affidavit, perhaps I'm going to make a note here so that I perhaps put a time limit on that subsection. In other words, that from the date of publication by the credit regulator informing the credit provider, they have 30 days to submit an affidavit. The idea with that affidavit is not for the affidavit to stop the application. It is simply to provide the credit provider with an opportunity to put their case forward. It is a bit difficult because there's not much that they can say against the debt relief being granted. If the consumer qualifies, the consumer qualifies. That's it. But it provides the credit provider with an opportunity to put their case forward just to allow for both sides of the case to be heard. That affidavit is considered by the regulator with the application, and if it doesn't say, you know, that there's a lie by the consumer, I almost can't see that affidavit really affecting the application because it's certain facts. Are you indigent? Do you not have, you know, do you qualify all of those things for indigent? Is your debt before this time? Is your debt less than this amount? If all of those boxes are ticked, the person qualifies. So I think we can put just a date there, a time there, so that we don't make that an open-ended thing. So I'm just going to make a time limit to that. In respect of penalties and offences, and I think the same, Mrs. Fubbs, you also mentioned something about penalties. No, it's something different. In respect of penalties and offences, the monitoring issue was brought up by Mr. McPherson as well. And it's perhaps something that the regulator can just help us with so that we can just get our minds around what type of measure can they do. Is there something already available? Do we need to provide for it? and then we can provide for that. We can look at making certain things an offence. It is possible. It is not, like I said, there is a precedent for persons who do not communicate a change in financial circumstances for that to be an offence. We can add that. Do we want to add that? Maybe we don't want to make it an offence. Maybe we want to be very clear about what the penalties are. Currently I'm a little bit vague. I'm giving a little bit of discretion to the tribunal. But perhaps we can make it very specific that if you do not inform us of your circumstances, or if this or that or the following, then your debt relief will be cancelled from the date of the order. In other words, any benefit that you receive will fall through. None of that will be there. The interest will be charged from that date. That's the kind of thing that we can do. The problem just with penalties is this person can't afford to pay their debt already. How will they be able to afford to pay a penalty? But I mean, those are things that we can think about. It is definitely something to because the problem is that if we put a bill out there without teeth, it is useless. So yes, we need to maybe find that balance. I'm hoping that perhaps from trade and the regulator side, they can maybe also give us some information on the type of penalties that can apply. Perhaps this is the type of penalty where we should say, now you don't qualify for credit for the next 10 years. Something like that. But do we then not push this person into the hands of the backstreet credit providers? I don't know. It's such a complex question to think about. But it's something I'll make a note. It's something that we need to think about. To look at labor, it's definitely something that we can do. We can consider, maybe have some discussions with labor. I'll chat with the credit regulator to hear if there is maybe already a relationship, if there is a database like that. What would people register for? I'm thinking of UIF, that kind of information. Is there an agreement to exchange information? Because that is something that we then can provide. If we put in something to that effect, we will just have to consult with the Minister of Labour so that they are happy with that inclusion. But that can be done as well. In respect of porn, Mrs. Fox, the actual slide excludes porn agreement.
William, I
hear what you are saying about the let's see if we have to get it right on there. Porn transactions, for some reason, are mentioned in the Credit Act, but they are specifically excluded from certain agreements. So a porn agreement will not qualify, a porn transaction, whatever credit arises from that. I suppose there might be a situation where, depending on the type of transaction with the porn shop, there is something to be repaid as well, but those do not qualify because there is an asset that will be sold if the person does not pay up. But they definitely do not qualify for wants of debt relief. So it is on slide 8. I'm saying the type of debt: no pawn transactions, mortgages, or credit guarantees. So they are definitely excluded from this. The issue of the, I think that is more or less almost answered as well. The fact of a sudden fire, you're almost ready to enter the credit market again, and then suddenly life happens. But the public interest loans in terms of Section 11 will not really help the one person whose shack has burned down. It might help if in IY, in House Bay, where the whole IY burned down. That is maybe the kind of thing where the minister can make public loans available. But also, if the person's shack then burned down, that is then the instance where that person should approach the credit regulator and say, I was almost out, and now this happened. And then the credit regulator must relook at that application. So an application must stay open with the credit regulator until the very end. So if it is before the end, then they will go back, And then perhaps in that instance, and that is why I think it is very important for the tribunal to have a discretion on the number of agreements, that a number of orders that can be made. So in that instance, the tribunal might say, look, what I'm going to do for you is I might now suspend these agreements that you have entered into to help you over this other thing that has now happened in your life. The issue of debt review and a court order and how that interacts with the actual applying. Let me see if I can get the actual slide easily. It is slide 9. What we have here is that a consumer might already have started, or a credit provider might already have started one of two processes in respect of the debt. The one might be civil action, and then one might be debt review. What I'm saying with this is, if the credit provider started civil proceedings in a court, we will say to the consumer, you need to go to court. You can't just come to the credit regulator, because that could frustrate the court process. But the court might say, but no, this is a situation where I can see that you would have qualified. The debt is before this date, the debt is less than this amount, what are your circumstances, and then refer to the regulator. So that is where the court will refer it. Now, if the consumer started the debt review process, I'm saying that there are two options. The committee can decide, no, if you have a debt review undergoing, you should not come and ask for debt relief. We cut you out. That is a possibility. I have not done that in the bill. I have allowed a person that is subject to that debt review to come and apply for debt relief. My rationale for that is it makes a little bit more work for the regulator. That is true. But the regulator can say, no, you are a very good candidate for debt review. We're going to refer you back, and you should continue with your debt review. So there is a bit of a, but it just allows the person who is undergoing debt review and might be at that point where they are now struggling to actually get and qualify for debt relief. So the last one was a mechanism to get it known about the changing, and I think that's the same issue of the penalty. The Honourable Tiago and Honourable von Galway mentioned that we know how to get this information. One of the things, of course, is if we put in a penalty, and that penalty is something that might benefit a credit provider, they might become the informant. It's a possible way of doing it. It's not something that I necessarily would recommend, but practically speaking, if you say the fact that you didn't tell us that you got a job might take the debt relief away, the credit provider might keep an eye on whether the person actually got a job and might report that. If that is the kind of culture that we want to promote, I don't know. It might be a solution. We might have to look at it a bit differently. I might be putting it really too bluntly, but there might be other mechanisms, and maybe the regulator can also help us with those type of mechanisms. Awareness campaigns and things like that might also assist in that regard.
That did address most of them there.
You see, members, as I say, we're going to have this great opportunity. We've been here, right at the beginning, at this first phase here, and I think that's been very helpful. We've just, the Hermans has been checking to see, because it seems that Catherine, I think, from National Treasury may want to, just sitting in here, what's going on, et cetera, et cetera. She may, of course, also want to engage somebody like yourself, Advocate van der Merwe, myself, but outside of the meeting itself, so that she is on track with the bill as she seeks to finalise the research that she has been pursuing on behalf of National Treasury. But I think, members, we've really done a great deal of work today. We've got this bill. We can now go and study it this evening, come back tomorrow morning, bright and early, and engage with the bill. Now, tomorrow we spend 2 hours, 2 solid hours, on the deliberations, as it were, and which, let me just check the meeting area, MM Mark 315. A lot of the venues have been taken, 8:30. Now, I do know that the buses this morning were problematic from the villagers, and I have spoken to the powers that be who look after this, pointing out that the buses have to return, have to be here at Parliament by 8:15 at the latest, 8 o'clock for 8:15, so that members can be on time for their committee meeting. So I think it's only 2 members in front of me here who are utilising the buses. Is that not correct? You've got your car, Honourable Williams. And so does Honourable Charlie. Are you within spitting distance, as it were? Yeah. So, and then, yes, I've also got a little car. But there's a couple of things here that one does want to really get into. So I hope trade and industry members will be up to the mark tomorrow. I believe the DDG will be here, the acting DDG, the Honourable Mr. Nyakitenzi. We know that probably you will be here yourself, National Credit Regulator, and everyone else. So I hope we'll be able to deal with the minutes some point tomorrow before we immediately go into the finance, Joint Finance Committee meeting, which I understand from Mr. Williams is going to take place in the same venue, because they never got a venue themselves. So we'd be there. But I know that some of you have got other committees, and I'm just trying to refresh my memory. Is that yourself, Honourable Tierko? Is it yourself, Honourable Van Schalkwyk, tomorrow? Don't you have another committee at about 10:30, 11:30 sort of thing? Yeah. So we are going to ask you to ask if you can stay till 10 and then move on. But you're also short, because we need to pass minutes tomorrow and take a decision. But look, let's see what we can do. You've been here today. We expect that we will be joined by the Honourable Linguini, who had challenges with the Eastern Cape and the flight. And we know that the Honourable MacPherson will also be here, so that's another 2 members. But it simply replaces the 2 we'll leave to follow. So we need yet another member as well. We do have a decision to take, members, a very important decision. The previous term we dealt with localisation, etc., and we've got to get this in order to be able to embark on, acquiring the resources we need to address this. So it is important that at some stage we have 7 members here. That's the point I'm really trying to make. So we know that everyone will be here at 8:30. So perhaps we've got to think of taking that decision at 9:15. You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So that the decision is taken. I hope everyone understands that. And we can at least pass 2 sets of minutes. Have the minutes been distributed? They were, I know, before constituency. Please drag out your minutes, familiarize yourself with them, and bring them in. There's not enough paper, really. Okay. So, on that note, I'd like to thank members of DTI, all the other members from the various units, yourself, Advocate van der Merwe, and those members of the public who are regularly with us. Thank you very much for being here with us today. Thank you. Meeting adjourned until tomorrow in Mark's building, 8:30.